Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview I did with Andre Malayev Babel. Andre teaches the first year acting class at the Oslo Conservatory. I'm replaying Andre's interview, not only because it is a fascinating, very, very unusual and inspiring story of a man who managed to come to a country where he hardly spoke the language and create a life, a career, a work in theater, but because in the ensuing weeks, I'm going to be playing interviews with several of the students who recently graduated from the Oslo Conservatory, who studied, had their first year with Andre, and talk a great deal about the impact of that year on them, not only as actors, but as human beings. And I want you to have had an experience of the man they're describing. By the way, as I did this interview last year, when Andre talks about the play that he directed, The Game of Love and Chance, that was last year. So don't rush down to the Oslo to see it. But enough of that. Hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive, finding wisdom's other words. Oh, you really can. And it's always there, like a silent hug from nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time says all on tap. Oh, I really can. Oh, I really can. Turn down all the noise so
hello, and welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about discovering, finding, recovering, uncovering who you really are, and then becoming it. As a psychotherapist, I've been in practice for well over 30 years now, and as a human being who just lives in this world and observes myself and everybody else, it has become clear to me that most of us are not actually who we really are. We're demonstrating, presenting, giving the impression of somebody who is much of what we are, but certainly most of us are keeping secrets about who we really are, what we really think, what we can really do. And the worst part of that is that we're not only keeping those secrets from other people, we're keeping those secrets from ourselves. I'm not talking about pretending that you're smarter than you are, or that you know things that you don't know, or that you can do things that you can't do. I'm not talking about the kind of pretending where we know we're giving a false impression, laughing at a joke you didn't get, you know, that stuff. We all do that, and okay. I'm talking about something much deeper and, in its way, much more dangerous. I'm saying, and I believe, that most of us, dare I say all, learn in our childhood that there are parts of ourselves which are too dangerous, embarrassing, threatening to present. Those giants on whom our life depends don't like it that we cry or make a lot of noise, or that we're clever, or that we get hurt, or that we get sick, or that we're slow at learning numbers, or you know, it doesn't matter what it is. And it doesn't take abuse to shut a child down. It can take the rolling of the eyes, the ignoring, the teasing. Any number of things can, and it doesn't even have to be intentional, it can be unintentional. By a loving parent can do something in the heat of a moment. I've seen this over and over in my practice. That parent may never do that thing again, but if it is dramatic enough, it serves to damage the child's idea of what it is that they can or should be. And I believe this happens to most of us. And so we live a life that is in alienation from ourselves. And this show is dedicated to the premise that we can all rediscover ourselves. In the book I wrote, When You Can, You Will, I talk about it as we're a plane that's flying along on one engine, when actually we have other engines. And when we discover them and turn them on, oh my God, what a shift. What a better way to be in the world. So I hope that you believe me, and that you've been listening. Most of the shows I talk about what stops us from becoming who we really are. And then I play interviews. I do a series called Anatomy of an Artist. I interview people who make their living or their life with their art, because it is my belief that, at least in this culture, nobody would be an artist unless it was absolutely who they really were. We make it so hard on artists, so hard on people who want to give their life to dance, to art, to fine art, to writing, to architecture, to anything that is an art. So I interview these people so that you can hear what it sounds like. And today, oh, you know, I always forget, so I'm going to do it now, and then hopefully I'll do it at the end. I do have a website. It is thelynnshow.com, T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E. Don't leave the E out, because there is another The Lynn Show. T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E-S-H-O-W.com. Today, my interview is with a guy who, as you will hear, knew who he was from the very beginning and was surrounded by the encouragement that makes us being who we are inevitable. It's such a lovely story. And so it made it possible for Andre Malay of Babel to emigrate to a country where he could barely speak the language and make a life in theater. I hope that you are as inspired by this story as I am. And also, Andre is talking, I don't want to forget this, about the play he directed for the Oslo Repertory Theater in Sarasota, Florida, called The Game of Love and Chance. You'll hear all about it. So here, Andre Malayev Babel. I am here with Andre Malayev Babel in his office in the Oslo building to talk to him about the play he is directing. The Game of Love and Chance.
The Game of Love and Chance by Marivo. He is not a very well-known playwright, but I think he is very esteemed in France. And he has done rather frequently, but not so frequently that...
That he's a household name.
He's a household name.
Right, right, right. Okay, so let me explain to you that I do an internet radio show on which I do interviews. It's a series called Anatomy of an Artist. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. Clearly you are doing that. And I always ask the same question, and that is, how did the art capture you? How did it happen? How did it start? How did it get you?
But just the atmosphere in which I grew up was very artistic. Because my grandfather was a writer, my grandmother was working, getting his works published, and or writing memoirs about him. There were lots of kind of friends at the house constantly who were either writers or actors or directors or artists. My mother was an architect. So the atmosphere, as you see, was very artistic. And
where did you grow up?
In Moscow. In Moscow, and in Russia's capital, at that point the capital of the Soviet Union. So I think that this is how it all started. So there are lots of inspiration. I was taken to concerts, musical theater, you know, drama theater.
So the whole idea of being a creative and artistic person, I mean, it's almost as though one wouldn't have come out of that soup as something else?
Probably not. Probably not. I mean, literature would have been another avenue, perhaps, but now I'm writing, but you see, I'm writing about theater, or I'm writing adaptations of plays. So I'm doing different things. I studied music, and I still continue working with music, but it's music for the theater. If I write, it's about the theater, or for the theater. I act, direct, I teach. So you see, I do
it's
many
all the
things,
theater,
yes, but they're all dedicated to the theater.
Well, okay, so how did that happen, the love affair with the theater?
It's difficult to say, but, you know, it started very early because, as all of the kind of children who grow up to be actors, I was doing some kind of domestic performances at a very early age, puppet theater, which is also very traditional. I was also directing because there were these performances that usually were connected with birthday parties. And guests would come, and inspired by one family tradition that I observe, I would write a play, which was usually a parody, a burlesque on some famous fairy tale or something. I'd write music for it, I would like songs, would write songs for it, and I would direct the guests, who were all obviously adults, and I was a little kid, I would direct them in this performance.
How old were you when you started doing this?
Oh, I don't know, probably we are talking about 12 years old, something like that.
Yes.
So I would direct them, and then they would basically perform this at the end of the party.
They would indulge you?
They would absolutely indulge me, and for quite a while, actually, because of how early I started directing, I was working with actors who were sometimes significantly older than I was.
Yes, but you had the permission, the encouragement, I don't know what the word is, that it wasn't a stretch, of course, he can do this.
I was surprised, but yes, I did get that permission, and nobody ever really doubted me because of my age.
Right. Nobody said, who do you think you are, or what do you think you're doing, or
any of that. No, for some reason, people kind of went along.
Yeah.
Probably long before I knew what I was really doing.
I'm sure that's right.
Yeah, they kind of went along. Yes,
I'm sure that's right. And that is such an incredible gift to someone who's, whatever it is you're going to do, if people start right off telling you that you have the right to do it, that you're good at it, that, you know, I mean, at the beginning, no one ever really is, so, but to get that right off the bat, there's no struggle attached.
Yeah, to get that acceptance.
Yes.
I wouldn't say that I had to seriously fight for it, because when I entered theater school in Moscow, I entered on the directing track, and I was 19. And all of my fellow students were in their 30s or even 40s, because the idea was in Russia, at least the idea is that if you are training to be a director, you need to have had some professional experience and certainly have certain knowledge of life.
Oh my God. So how did you...
I don't know. I was the only probably person in the history of that school, at least, you know, as far as I'm aware, who was accepted onto the directing track at that age.
And did you know at the time how unusual that was?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. I was trying to actually enter on a more typical kind of, for my age, acting track.
Right, so that you could get the acting and the life behind you.
Of course, and I would enjoy it. And I continued acting and I act still. Mm-hmm. Right, but that's not wasn't the emphasis of my training. And thankfully, the Russian idea of training directors is that they have to go through the entire acting program.
Yes.
And then on top of it, they have to learn to direct because, you know, you're ending up working with actors, so you might as well know how actors
work.
What
a concept.
What a concept, exactly.
So were you doing them at the same time?
It was the program for directors, but acting classes were just part of the curriculum.
Yeah,
in right. addition to directing, the history of theater, the history of art, and other subjects.
You loved them all.
Especially studying the communist science, because we're talking about the 1980s.
So what is the communist science?
Well, it's whatever Marx said and wrote and Lenin and so on. So all these subjects are no longer taught in Russian theater schools or any other schools for that matter.
But you know them.
But there was such a, well, it would be a huge exaggeration. I mean, nobody really held us kind of responsible to knowing this, but it was so-called scientific communism. Can you imagine?
No.
There is such thing as scientific communism.
Yes.
So that's what it was in the history of the Communist Party and, you know, things that.
But these are required subjects.
The required subjects until after the time of perestroika, obviously, you know, and I was... You know, in school.
You were before that.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So you, at 19, with this huge block of experience behind you, already have written and acted and directed, really, essentially, most of your life, right? You go to school and you... Now, did you think you had to unlearn stuff? I mean, were you stubborn or were you open? Was it easy for you? Do you know what I mean?
I was open. I think that I wasn't a very good student because certain things came easy to me. And I think a lot of things I did just to satisfy the requirement. Unfortunately, this student mentality is not uncommon. And now that I work with students a lot,
you know, of course, I
recognize it.
Yeah.
You know, and I do realize that there's a lot of things that I thought I understood and I didn't really. And I think that this is something that's, again, very common.
That was the question. That's actually the question I was asking. Mm-hmm. And I do think it's very common. I think it's especially common, well, maybe this is an exaggeration or maybe this is a myth. But in order to be an actor, you really do have to believe that you have something to offer, that you know something, right? You can't get up there, you know.
You better have the sense of purpose behind this. Why you are doing it, what it is that you are either trying to contribute, or at least what it is that you cannot help but express. Cannot help but say
to the audience. Yes. So maybe this isn't true, but it seems to me, just talking to you, that that pretty much... all of the people who do this will come to learning with a kind of sense, I already know this. Is that wrong?
In contemporary situation, yes, because especially if we are talking about graduate school, usually people come to the graduate acting training program like ours with some undergraduate background.
Yes.
And it usually is in theater and in acting. But if you really look at how popular the art of acting is nowadays, and we have programs like the Actor Studio or some other programs where actors constantly talk about their art.
Right.
Think that even when you come to the undergraduate program, you already have formed certain ideas.
Yes.
You heard something at least about method. You heard some actors interviewed. They told you exactly how
they did it.
And so you already come with certain idea. Probably, maybe you were taking theater classes in high school.
Right.
Lots of high schools have theater and acting classes nowadays.
Yes.
So really, I don't think that we are coming as a clean slate, which used to be the case with the actors of the old times, before Stanislavski, before the schools of acting, where actors really came as a clean slate and they were immediately thrown into practice, and they failed and failed and failed until they succeeded, unless they had this extraordinary gift Were
kind
they,
of natural.
Exactly. So that is where I think we are at a certain disadvantage, because depending, of course, on what it is that you heard, on what it is that you've been exposed to, once you enter, let's say, a conservatory or even undergraduate program that has very particular set of beliefs, you may have to unlearn. You may already have to actually kind of be prepared for a certain turnaround instead of just absorbing what you are given.
Yes, and I imagine that's difficult to do. I'm difficult for, I mean, again, maybe this isn't true, but I imagine that is difficult
and
for
learning
actors.
Is much more difficult than learning.
Well, just as a general rule it is, but I would think for actors it's even more difficult. Because it's their very self. It's not something, it's not something they're writing on a pad. Or,
yes, it is. It's their body, their nerves,
yes,
their imagination, their feelings. It's them.
Yes, that's right. And then, and people are observing it.
Yes.
So so imagine it's quite difficult if you've already decided this is right for me, this is how I should do it, and then to have to undo
that. And I'm not even talking about how accessible all kinds of movies and TV programs are today. So these young people, they have seen movies from the 30s, from the 40s, contemporary movies, soap operas,
right?
It's TV shows and so on, and every time it's some kind of a very different style of acting.
Yes.
And very different way of kind of living on stage or living on the screen, right?
Yes.
Or just performing. So I think already this influence is there. They're copying a favorite actor, for example, and their style and so on.
Yes, yes.
And so there's a lot there already, which I suppose usually is not hugely helpful.
No, I'm sure that's correct. I'm sure that's correct. Okay, so now we're a little ahead of where I want to follow this line, but I want to go back. So at 19, was that true of you?
Yes, definitely, because I was very much enamored with certain style of acting and certain actors who probably would be called character actors. And the art of physical characterization, external characterization, actually is really disappearing from contemporary theater to a certain degree. Actors are much more likely to be more or less remaining themselves physically and being cast for their types rather than for their ability to be a chameleon,
something.
To become something.
Yes.
So we go to see a star because that star is predictable, because that star is mostly doing what they're doing, and that's what we kind of love about that star. In terms of transformation, well, this is usually kind of left to a makeup artist or something. Or sometimes we don't even ask for transformation. And I think that this style of acting was probably something that I really loved, because I loved these chameleons that I saw. But it's a very particular style and also a very different process, ultimately, that probably is not kind of a good thing to have as your starting point.
You grow into it.
You grow into it.
But this is the story of your life. You are starting at the top everywhere.
Yeah.
So this is just more of that, right?
Probably.
So what did they do with you, with this pipsqueak who came in with this idea about character
acting?
Well,
I think that they brought us back to the truth, back to I am, so that you're not even playing any character. But, of course, that's also deceiving, because if you realize, understand it literally, and you decide that, so first I need to learn how to just be myself on stage.
Yes.
That's also not true, because, of course, whenever the circumstances of your character's life are different from your circumstances,
then you can't be yourself.
You can't be yourself.
Right.
You have to transform.
Right.
So this whole idea that this is really you is nothing but a pedagogical tactic. But if you really believe in it, I think you're also going to get stuck with the idea that, I actually don't need to transform.
Yes.
Right? But transformation happens from day one. Without transformation, without the work of imagination, where you suddenly find yourself in a different situation and therefore certain different aspects of you come out, aspects that maybe don't usually come out in everyday life. Without that idea, you also don't have a very clear vision of the process, because the process is you got to become different. even though you also cannot become entirely different so that you lose yourself in it. So you have to remain yourself while becoming different. And that's the contradiction number one, which is very difficult for actors to really understand.
Yes.
Finally, if you don't become different, then you will never be able to experience what the character experiences ultimately. Without transformation, you will not have access to your artistic emotions.
And it won't work. It won't be real. We won't believe it.
No.
Right.
So transformation and experience, emotional experience, go together, actually.
Okay, so that's what they tried to help you learn, or did help you learn, or focused on
I
for you?
I think that probably the approach to acting, considering that we were really training as directors, was a little bit of a shortcut approach. And we were trained, and we even had, you know, a full-blown production that we performed as actors at the end of our training. But I think that we were always looked upon, they kind of cut us a slack, so to speak.
Hmm.
They didn't use the same measures with us as they used with those who were on the acting track. We were supposed to be training as directors.
Yes.
And as long as we are passable actors, I think they were absolutely satisfied.
Okay,
you know,
I got
the standards were different.
I see. So you skipped a step.
Yes, and then I was really discovering myself as an actor later in my career after I have graduated
as a director. Okay, so then what happened? So and now you're graduating as a director younger than anybody, right?
Yes, by that time I already had an amateur theater company that I organized and was running for a while.
I see.
I was doing it parallel to my training. And then finally this theater company, after I graduated, became my first priority, and the company developed into a professional company. It was one of the first private theater companies in Russia after Perestroika. Because before Perestroika you couldn't start anything.
No, it doesn't matter what it is.
Right. You know, whether it's a, you know, grocery shop or theater company, nothing
right.
could be
No,
private.
No.
Yeah. So because of the shifts in the policy, we were actually able to, you know, incorporate.
Perfect timing for you.
It was a
You're standing on the edge with this thing ready to go the minute, right?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I worked with this company for about 8 years, and it's during these 8 years that I had a co-director who is now, you know, in Russian TV business. He's a producer and host with Russian TV, and together we were kind of leading this company. He was directing, I was acting, he acted occasionally, but he also took care of all the management, which right now I understand that I should really be bowing before him for having taken that load off of my shoulders. And this company worked mostly with classical plays, but not your kind of, again, we talked about household names. There were not household name classics. There were less known classical authors.
Yeah.
So, and then ultimately we traveled all over Russia, or what was Soviet Union at that time. We traveled extensively. We performed in Moscow. And we started an exchange program with two theater companies from the United States by the early 90s. And it's basically at that point that I came on an exchange, on a cultural exchange program, I came to the United States.
When was that?
That was 91.
Wow. Wow. And so here you are. So can you say how that happened?
That happened because my aunt actually lived in Washington, D.C. She was a friend with a university professor through her husband. And this university professor working at the University of Maryland, he knew these actors who were very much interested in Russian theatrical tradition, because part of their training was supposed to be Stanislavski's based. So they wanted to learn more.
Yeah.
And when this university professor, who was a professor of sociology, his name was John Robinson, he was a Russian sociologist, so he came to Russia frequently. He got to see our productions, he liked them, and he said, you really need to connect with my theater friends in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And then we started simply going and visiting each other. Again, this was perestroika time.
Yes, yes, yes.
So it became possible. The
yes.
Iron Curtain was lifted.
Yes.
Something like this would have been
Never.
Entirely impossible. Yeah. I, you know, let's say in the early 80s, it would have been impossible. Even in the mid-80s, it was problematic. But by late 80s, early 90s, it became possible. So what happened then, it was kind of, well, we come and see you, you come and see us, and then I said, how long are we going to be going and seeing each other? Let's produce something together. So I really started trouble. And we did produce two productions, one classical Russian farce, another classical American farce. We rehearsed it in Moscow and showed it in Moscow. And then we rehearsed...
Both of them.
Both of them. We rehearsed them it further in L.A., and we showed them in L.A.
Where?
It was it's an old historic theater called Heliotrope Theater.
Yes, I know it.
So, yeah. So...
Did you do the Russian play in Russian?
Russian actors in Russian, American actors in English. It was a bilingual production.
Wow.
Which was another very kind of bold step.
Yeah, no kidding.
So that's how we kind of stirred trouble and brought this collaboration further than just cultural exchange.
Yes, yes.
Because
yes.
cultural exchange is usually just mutual visits.
Right, and hello, goodbye.
Hello, goodbye.
Right.
So that was a huge thing that we did. Actually.
So then, I mean, somehow you wound up here.
Yes, I mean, it happened for two reasons, and one reason, which is very important reason, is my wife. I met my wife on my first trip to D.C. She was in the sociology class led by that very professor of sociology, Jen Robinson, that I told you about. And she came to class late that day. She was considering skipping class, but then said, okay, these two Russian actors are going to be our guest speakers. So that's curious. So she at the last moment she decided to make the class, and she came in late, and the only free seat was smack in the first row. So needless to say, she attracted attention, and I approached her after the class. And at that point, I think my English was still pretty bad. I was almost kind of approaching her through my interpreter.
So you went up to this woman and you couldn't really talk to?
I couldn't really talk to her the way that I would, kind of as freely as I wanted
yeah.
to. And then gradually we went to the theater together, and we met on other occasions. And that was still the trip where I was just enjoying, you know, watching theater and sightseeing
right.
And so on. And then on the last night in D.C., I asked her if she would come to Moscow, and she said that she would, and she actually did, which was her first trip away from home, I think, in any direction.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
So and she certainly didn't speak any Russian.
And she didn't speak any Russian, so she was there really at my mercy. So that was very brave of her to do it. So, and kind of the rest is history.
It's history, exactly right. Well, and then when you two realized, whatever, that you wanted to be together, I guess there was no chance she was going to go live in Moscow.
Well, you guessed that right. I was inviting her and asking her that she, you know, that she would consider. But yes, my wife Lisa, she said no. She wasn't interested in living in Russia. And at the same time, it was interesting because my career in the States was kind of developing. Theaters also weren't doing exactly what they should have been doing, but they were staging all of this depressing...
I was going to say they weren't doing comedy.
...about how tough
yeah.
your life is.
See, in America, in the Depression, we knew better, and we had all those wonderful comedies,
oh,
right?
Yes. Oh, yes. Because it was a very strange period in Russia where audience stopped going to the theater. And you probably know Russian theatrical culture and how important theater is
yes.
in the Russian cultural
yes.
tradition. But it was very difficult period of the early 90s where there were such great hardships and people were so depressed. But I understand why it happened, you see, because there are so many topics that were forbidden. That when suddenly it was allowed to talk about contemporary problems and hardships
yes.
and social ills,
yeah, 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 yeah.
right?
They wanted to
do it. And audiences had so much of it kind of in their own front yard.
Right, exactly. Right.
That they just refused to go. So it all fortunately reversed because theaters understood that they need to do classics.
Right.
And audiences immediately came back as long as, you know, as soon as theaters started doing classics. And by that time, however, I was already actually teaching at the Catholic University of America in D.C. at the drama department. I was first a resident director at the Chamber Theater, which was a D.C. company, and then I was, you know, doing lots of classes also in D.C., training actors. And actually, in 98, I started my own theater company in Washington, D.C.
Wow.
So it kind of so happened that I was really able, obviously,
with
the support of my family, my wife, I was able to make a life here, the theater professional, which I must say is very rare.
No kidding.
Let's face it, most of the people who immigrate do not end up working in the field that they trained in.
Not only most of the people who emigrate, most of the people who decide they want to be in theater in the United States don't wind up working in their chosen career.
Unfortunately, is also.
Oh my God, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I think it speaks probably to your talent, your skill, and your perseverance.
Simply because of what we talked about earlier. The fact that I am able to do so many things in the theatrical field.
Yes.
Because maybe if I could only do one thing,
yes,
I would not have made it.
Yes.
But because I can teach and I can act and I can direct, you know, and now I write about theater,
maybe
this is what's kind of helping me to stick to theater and not to have to do
You can have
things.
That if you like. I think it's probably talent, skill, and perseverance myself.
All right, well, I was learned to always take credit, so I'll take credit.
Yes, yes. And you know, to go back, I really believe that that early experience of you can do it, you should do it, we want you to do it, we like it that you do it, that never leaves you. That becomes a part of how you feel about yourself, and you present that wherever you go. You present, oh, you should want me, you're going to want me, you know. And I think that that's...
I think that this is what was driving me for quite a while. I mean, every artist hits a certain crisis point. And I think that probably I also at some point while in D.C. hit that crisis point where I was actually beginning to doubt. I don't know if it was I was doubting myself or was I doubting that I can continue developing and grow in that particular environment. But you are right. I think for quite a long time I was driven by the license kind of and
that's,
the support.
That's exactly right. That is exactly the kind of word I was looking for.
Yeah.
So how did you wind up in Sarasota, Florida?
Well, I was, it's the magic number 8 because I was, my theater company in Moscow existed for 8 years, and my DC theater company, which was very successful and won lots of Helen Hayes awards and nominations and was embraced by the community, by the kind of theater-going audience and also by the press, also existed for 8 years. This is where I have to go back to the time in Moscow where I was running a theater company as co-artistic director, but I didn't have to lift my finger.
Yes, because you had a manager.
To fundraise, let's
say.
Yes. Or to even worry about, you know, how we're going to get paid at the end of the month.
Yes.
And not to mention all of the administrative work and so on. So that is something that I certainly got a full taste of in D.C. because I was producing artistic director, so not only was I, you know, directing and acting in some of the productions and, you know, in charge of the repertoire and casting, I was also in charge of the entire administrative operation and fundraising, which is absolutely oi. So again, the people who know how to do it and people who have talent to do it and people who enjoy doing it earned my respect.
God bless them.
God bless them. And God bless the people who give to the arts. But let's face it, it's not easy.
No.
Especially when you are at the same time running, you know, running artistic kind of operations. So, or trying to continue developing as an artist. So 8 years was kind of enough.
Right.
And I said that I think that by now the managing part of it is really beginning to affect, is really beginning to affect how I develop as an artist. I also missed teaching, because I was teaching at the Catholic University of America for quite a while, but eventually the company took priority.
Yeah.
I was teaching there for 2 years as a full-time professor, and then I continued teaching beyond that, actually, doing very different classes for a while, but I was missing a formal training, because our training at the theater was actually all dedicated to productions. We tried to do formal training, but then a deadline would come and we'd start training actors specifically
for the part.
For the demands of this production.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Be it the part or be it particular, you know, technique that they had to do it, because a lot of this theater was movement-oriented. There was a lot of movement, dance, singing, pantomime. So it was really a theater of synthesis where drama coexisted with other arts. So at that point, I felt that I would like to do teaching full-time again. And I would like to continue doing theater projects in my spare time, which I do.
Right.
But I really wanted to get back to teaching full-time.
And you wanted to stop fundraising.
And I wanted to stop fundraising badly, yes.
Yeah.
And I applied for this position, and I was so fortunate that the opening came.
What is this position?
It's a first-year acting professor, acting teacher. So I teach actors in their first year at the conservatory, and I direct in the second year. I direct one of the productions in the second year.
Well, let's talk about that now. So you've directed the Game of Love and Chance. Is that correct?
Well, I'm directing the Game of Love and Chance. It's,
yes?
It's still happening.
Oh, yes. I didn't mean to... Yes, I know. It hasn't opened yet.
Yes.
I know. Yes. You are directing the Game of Love and Chance. Okay. So do you want to just tell us a little bit about that?
It's an 18th century play written and performed in 1730 by French playwright Marivaux, but interestingly enough performed by an Italian company in Paris.
In French?
In French. There was an Italian Commedia dell'arte company in Paris for quite a while.
Wow.
And Marivaux mostly collaborated with them. He didn't collaborate with Comédie Française as much, even though he did write for them. His favorites were Comédie Italienne, and he wrote for those actors.
Do you know why?
I think I do now. Because... the Italian tradition, the Commedia dell'arte tradition, was appealing to him. It's very different. It's based, as you know, on some stock characters, on masks.
Yes.
It is a very passionate art, because if a French actor is passionate, but these passions are somewhat reserved.
Yes.
Italian actors' passions are
out there.
Out there.
Yes.
So I think that it's a combination of this very particular type of comedy and the combination of kind of, and their emotional way of living on stage that is responsible for him being partial to the Italian actors. At the same time, he brought to these Italian actors a very unknown and obviously desired dialogue, because as you know, commedia texts are very specific. They're often improvised.
Oh, no, I didn't know.
If they are not improvised in the Italian commedia, then they are not really... dedicated to any particular plot. The plot is very secondary. The story is secondary. It's, the story is just an opportunity for actors to demonstrate their art.
Uh-huh.
How emotionally available they are, how passionate they are, how funny they are.
So it's improv mostly?
It's mostly improv, even though a lot of these texts, of course, were memorized, but they were, I think, combining them in unexpected ways.
Yes, and they were flexible.
They were incredibly flexible. And the plot was not really there. Neither there were really characters in the realistic contemporary understanding of the characters.
Right.
They were masks.
But this, was a play. This was written, this play.
This was written, and what Marivaux introduced to the Italians, of course, is a plot, is an elaborate story, and characters who were closer to the contemporary French reality.
And did they like that? I mean, it's a structure. I would have thought they would have sort of rebelled against that structure.
That's exactly what I thought as well. But apparently because the tastes of the French audience of the time demanded it. And without the support of this audience, they were done for.
Yes, yes.
They had to adjust. They
were
very smart.
Right.
They were very smart. So they began to adjust. And Marivaux was exactly what they needed while they were exactly what Marivaux needed.
Yes.
So Marivaux is different, of course, because on one hand he introduces this what's even today known as marivadage, which is the art of witty dialogue, salon-like French dialogue, right?
We're
making love to each other, but doing it all through words, so to speak. So, and all of the intricacies of feelings and their development and, you know, and the development of love, how love is growing and all of the kind of story of what is happening between the two young people, the leads, all of it is beautifully expressed through this dialogue, but at the same time, there are servants. And the servants are very close to the commedia types. The main actor there performed the part of Harlequin. And even in the play, he appears as Harlequin.
Really?
You have Monsieur Argon, you have Lisette, you have Sylvia, right?
Yeah, stock characters.
Which are stock characters, but at the same time, they have contemporary French names, right? And then there's Harlequin.
I see.
So it's a very interesting mixture. It's a very interesting combination. So obviously Marivaux wanted these servants who play a very important role because the relationship between masters and servants is very crucial to Marivaux's play. He is very brave for the time, incredibly progressive in many respects. And the equality between masters and servants, kind of anticipating the French Revolution, which is about to come but is not there yet, right, is one of his themes and one of his kind of innovations, if you wish.
Wow. So now did you choose this play?
The play was chosen in consultation with our artistic director, our head of the conservatory director, Greg Lemming.
Yes. I know Greg and have interviewed him.
So. Sure.
Yeah. So, but you are pleased with it.
It's a wonderful opportunity for me to venture into something that I am less familiar with because I'm probably a much better expert on the 19th century, let's say, than I am on the 18th century.
Wow.
Because a lot of plays that I've staged before were either 20th century or 19th century plays. And I ventured into other centuries. I did Goethe's Faust, let's say. I did Cervantes' Don Quixote. But you can imagine that neither one could really prepare me for this type of a play.
Right. So not only are the actors having to brush up, so to speak, but you are.
It's a challenge because, yes, if I was working with, let's say, material that was very familiar, and I would just needed to introduce actors to this material, my life would have been much easier than having to immerse myself in this material, in this kind of layer of culture, society, literature, art, theater, then to actually bring it to contemporary conservatory second-year actors, who, as you can imagine, are also not familiar with
this. No, of course not. So, wow. In a way, I'm really glad that you're saying all this because, of course, I'm gonna broadcast this so that when people go, they'll know some of this because this is really interesting. I mean, it changes for me how I will see the play. You know, knowing this.
It's a fascinating time, which, first of all, has much more in common with our time than we might think. It's a time of economic crisis. It's a time of the so-called stock market crash.
Really?
It's a time of great uncertainty, political, social uncertainty. It's a time on the verge of the revolution. So it's a very exciting time that has actually many parallels with our time.
Yes.
The very reason Marivaux started writing was because he invested his rich wife's money into the Mississippi scheme, in the United States, and the Mississippi bubble burst.
Really?
And he lost all the money. Oh. So he had to now support himself as a writer.
Oh my God.
So it's very interesting. So you have some kind of, you know, parallel with the United States here. But what's more important is it is the, you know, it's a crisis. It's the depression that caused him to actually become a full-time playwright and to start earning his money this way. Many of these plays may not have been written if not for the depression and for the crisis.
Well, you know, what do they say? What is the mother of invention? Mm-hmm. Necessity is the mother of invention,
necessity
right?
is the mother of invention. A lot of uncertainty that you will see in these characters who are uncertain about their future, uncertain about their own heart, uncertain about the heart of the other person, is sometimes kind of connected with this overall sense of uncertainty in the society, living on the verge of a social shift.
And of course
the social shift is present there, if not directly, then indirectly, throughout all this concept of masters changing into servants, servants changing into masters.
Aye, yes.
Because they all assume somebody else's identity. The young people who want to be able to observe their intended without their intended knowing that they're being observed and to learn their true worth and who they really are, they change costumes with their servants for a day so that they could observe their intended as a servant.
And get a little bit more.
But of course,
than they expected.
Exactly. Because little do they know that their other party also did the same thing and exchange costumes with their servants.
Of course.
So while they're, you know, speaking with who they think is the master, they're really speaking with the servant and so on. So it's the confusion there, of course, is absolutely delicious from all this. But all of it is based not just on kind of the change of identity. It's incredibly brave for Marivaux's time.
As
the figure of a father who does not insist that his daughter marries the young man that
he chooses
but says, I actually want you to choose freely.
Oh.
It's not a typical 1730 father, let me tell you, right? And also, of course, this whole, even though, of course, he cannot go very far, so you will never see master flirting with the servant.
Right.
You know, they may be thinking that they're flirting with the servant, but they're really flirting with their equal, or they're getting involved with their equal.
Because of the double change.
Exactly.
Yes.
So, but at the same time, still, it was very much a hot topic, apparently. The play was in Marivaux's time. In today's time, obviously, this part of it is funny, but not nearly as relevant, because our society...
Or shocking.
It's so shocking. Right. Our society is certainly less divided in that way, even though, let's face it, it's still
much subtler and more underground. But
yes, and I think there's a lot of kind of political correctness on one hand.
Yeah, I agree.
And reality is something else entirely.
Yes,
right?
and the conflict between them.
Yeah.
So I imagine this play is difficult for your students.
It is difficult because it is 18th century France, because its style, it has commedia dell'arte aspects, it has this famous Marivaudage, which is also, believe me, you know, in the first year training in the realistic tradition.
You didn't do that, right?
No. So, I mean, a lot of it is incredibly challenging because of how many levels and how many notes do they have to hit simultaneously, and they have to remain truthful, because contemporary audience, of course, wants it.
Right. The other thing I was thinking was how difficult to be yourself in this character, because these people have so much freedom by comparison to the people they're playing.
I mean, what I think is incredibly relevant is, of course, the theme of pursuit of happiness.
Yes.
It's relevant in any...
Universal.
Absolutely universal. Because that's what they're doing. They're trying to pursue their own happiness. They have their own idea of happiness.
Right.
Sometimes this idea is very radical.
Yes.
It's everything or nothing type of idea, right? They're very romantic, some of these characters. So that is, of course, absolutely universal and timeless.
Yeah. Okay, I'd like to ask, well, first, if there's anything I didn't ask you that I should have, you should think of that and tell me. And second, you are someone who who has an entire life dedicated to the theater in various ways. You are truly, your life is what informed by your art, really. So if you would think for a moment about what that's like, what it's like to live a life that's completely dedicated to an art, if there's anything that you would want to say about that.
I consider myself lucky to be able to do what I am doing, and especially to do it having come to a different country, you know, having come to the United States. So I think that there are probably a lot of artists that you interviewed and a lot of artists who exist who have to suffer for their art much more than I do. I think we all have to suffer for it because it's all consuming. Very often family suffers because of this, and you know, people who are married to artists or live with artists, they of course they have to support very often in the way that they probably wouldn't have to support in such a radical way if they were married to saner people, right? To people who are a bit more normal and wouldn't. But the problem is that the creative process, of course, is a 24-hour process, and that's where
it's an obsession.
It's an obsession, and that's, you cannot really stop it. You know, you can't. I mean, you can try, of course, but usually it's kind of counterproductive. And great art happens when, of course, you dedicate all of you to it. So I think that from that standpoint, of course, it is difficult. Maybe more difficult even for those around us than for us. And yes, we also have to come and, you know, attend to reality, attend to our real duties while trying to pursue this. But I think that, as I mentioned and as we discussed, I enjoyed a lot of support and understanding.
Yes.
And also in terms of what you didn't ask, or rather what I didn't get to say, is that, of course, the reason that we can do the work that we are doing here is also because of this support.
Yes.
Because the tremendous support that we get here at the ASELO,
mm-hmm.
from our designers, from you know, from our technicians, builders, it's really something that, and not to mention administrations and people
who raise the money, right?
Yeah. And we also are incredibly privileged here and lucky to have the community that supports
Sarasota. Us. There's nothing like it.
Exactly.
Yeah, I know.
Exactly, because, you know, without that support, I don't know if we could do what we are doing.
Right.
So, again, I think that we are in a very lucky and fortunate situation overall,
yes.
in terms of being able to do what we are doing. And there are a lot of people who suffer for their art much greater, I think, than I do. You see, so again, I consider myself lucky and fortunate to be able to, as you said, dedicate my life to
yeah.
the arts and specifically to theater.
Well, that's great. This has been a wonderful, wonderful interview. Thank you so
much,
Andrea.
Thank you, brother.
So as too often is the case, I have run us right almost out of time, but I did not want to edit any more of that interview. I thought it was really fascinating. I hope you did too. But before I say goodbye, I have to, as always, thank Josh Hackney, my IT guru, who fixes, saves, corrects, teaches, shows how, and is always there with everything electronic, web, internet, computer, recording. And to tell you, as always, if you need any of this stuff, you need Josh Hackney. And to go to my website, thelinshow.com, and say, I want Josh. Or when you go to the website, you can say anything you like. Leave me a message, click on email me, and tell me anything you like. As always, I hope you heard something that you could use in this show. Something that interested you, that something you didn't know, something you knew that you forgot, something that will bring you back, because I will be here next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be too. You see?
I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some guy.